I'm an editor at Colorado Public Radio. If you're here for extreme weather, you're in the right place. So I appreciate you all coming in. Look, I just wanted to say hi to all the environment journalists and say hello, climate journalists, because you're all climate journalists now. Sorry, but that's just kind of colder. They're getting drier. They're getting wetter. You know, they're getting more extreme in every way. And things are just getting, you know, weirder. I don't know. But that's a lot of what we're seeing. And if you're doing any reporting in this space, you're reporting on extreme weather. Getting mosquitoes where there haven't been mosquitoes. People need AC where they never had AC before. Nights are getting hotter. Ice storms are popping up in places where people can't remember ever having an ice storm. Even fires in Colorado and lots of places are acting not in any way that we've ever seen fires act before. They're exhibiting behavior that's weird, it seems like a wholly new thing. So any one of these things, you know, alone is weird and scary and needs reporting. But there's a pesky extra layer on top of that, and that's us, right? It's the people that are not only fueling a lot of these problems, but have to live with it, have to live around it. But people aren't ready for any of this stuff, and they're not ready now, and they're not ready for a lot of what's coming, and a lot of the stuff we built, a lot of the built environment, the things that, in many cases, we built to tame nature, right, to hold it and to live with it, isn't ready either, and James is going to talk a little bit about that today. So I've got a good panel of folks much smarter than me to help talk you through some of this stuff. We'll talk about the links to climate change and extreme weather and how to be accurate about that when you're reporting on it. Talk to you about the built environment and some of the human decision making behind that built environment too. It's not just the stuff we build, but it's the human processes behind how we use the stuff that we build that is also going to be facing radical shifts. And we're going to give you some kind of ground level tips from people up here that have covered this for a long time and help you kind of sort this stuff out. In some cases, we have like an emergency, you know, kind of role to cover this stuff as it's happening. You know, it's disaster mode. Things are happening right in front of us. We want to be accurate and timely with our science and help people in when things are going awry. But we also should be doing good reporting before this stuff even happens. And we want to do good accountability reporting after it happens. And we'll hopefully be able to do that today. Introduce my panel, and we'll just go down the line. Shannon Osaka is a climate reporter at Grist. She's also a researcher who's researched the sociocultural dimensions of climate change, both at Princeton and Oxford, and she did that on a Sachs scholarship, so much brighter than me. So a journalist with a big, deep research background. James Doskalen is an assistant professor of civil and environmental engineering at Rice University down here, so... Welcome. I'm excited.
Welcome.
Yeah, I've read a bunch of his research lately. It's scary, which is good. And Mose Bushel, I've known Mose for a long time. He's a senior energy, environment, climate correspondent at KUT, which is the NPR member station in Austin. So excited to have everybody here today. I think, Shannon, you can kind of kick things off.
Do you have my slides?
Yes, I do. They're in there. You just hit that space bar.
Okay.
Okay, awesome. Yeah, so as Joe mentioned, I'm Shannon Osaka. I'm a climate and energy reporter at Grist. And I come from this to extreme event attribution, which is sort of the science of attributing extreme weather events to climate change from two different angles. One is as a reporter, I've covered this stuff. And the other is as an academic, I've studied some of the modeling behind extreme event attribution, also how it's been covered in the media and by policymakers. So this, I'm gonna give a little bit of an intro into the science, and then I'm gonna talk about four challenges that face reporters and kind of modelers when they're looking at extreme event attribution. So this is sort of a very typical statement that people would make in the mid-2000s, early 2010s, when they were talking about extreme weather and climate change. This is from the New York Times. It is impossible to attribute any single weather event to global warming. For those of you who have been in this a long time, you probably remember reading or maybe even writing this type of sentence many, many times. So that's still true up to a point. And the advent of a particular type of science, extreme event attribution, meant that while we scientists still generally can't say that an event was deterministically caused by climate change, they can say that it was made more likely or more severe by climate change. You'll see I have an asterisk on the can't because the chart on the right kind of shows what we're talking about when we talk about extreme event attribution. There's a couple different scientific methods, but this is the most popular one. Basically, what scientists will do is they will model the climate system under two different conditions. One is with all the anthropogenic greenhouse gases, aerosols, everything that we're spewing into the atmosphere, and the other is without. And so what they can do is they can run a bunch of, they can do a bunch of model runs, and they can look at the likelihood of this particular type of extreme event happening with and without those all those human things that we've been doing. So in this example, this is sort of, you know, just a hypothetical. This event, let's say it's a heat wave, without the human contribution of greenhouse gases, the chances of this event were like 1 in 60, now they're 1 in 5. So scientists can take that to say, you know, this event has been made X times more likely due to climate change. And so this has become really, really popular. Scientists are doing this all the time. These are some quotes from the bulletin of the American Meteorological Society, and they do these series where they talk about explaining extreme events for a particular year. And so, you know, they'll say, this extremely warm month was made 40 times more likely by climate change. And you can also have the reverse. You can have a finding that says, you know, this extremely cold period was made less likely due to climate change. And sometimes scientists do the analysis and they say, you know, we actually, you know, it was inconclusive. We weren't able to model the event that happened. And so there are those results as well. Carbon Brief has a really great map where they look at basically all of the major events that have been attributed. They have about 405 events on here right now. And they show all of the events where human influence was found, which is in red, no human influence found in blue, and then inconclusive in gray. So this is just shows like really the breadth of the events that they've done. And you know when I said gave that asterisk earlier about we can't say that an event was deterministically caused by climate change, well, now climate change has become so big that we're actually starting to be able to do that. So this is an example from the Pacific Northwest heat wave. I was in Seattle at the time. It was very intense. We were not prepared. People were doing crazy things trying to get air conditioners. And scientists looked at this and said basically that this particular heat wave was virtually impossible without climate change. So what that means in the context of this type of modeling is it means that they did the modeling and were basically not able to find any examples of when a heat wave like this would have happened without anthropogenic influence. So this is where we're starting to see actually for certain types of events, basically just heat waves at this point, that it was really impossible for this event. And so that might get pretty close to saying this was deterministically caused by. It's tricky when you're attributing extreme events to climate. So the first thing is that the type of extreme really, really matters. And so not so much. So you'll see extreme heat, extreme cold. We have a lot of understanding about how those events change with climate change. Droughts, extreme rainfall. We have less understanding, but it's still pretty strong. In the bottom left, you'll see we have wildfires and severe convective storms. So we're talking about tornadoes and things like that. And those like, tornadoes are really hard to model. They occur at very small spatial scales, which are hard to model using climate models. So this is just something to think about when you're looking at attribution studies. Think about what type of event it is and how much knowledge we really have about that type of event. Then the other thing is that sometimes you'll have the same event and you'll have different findings. So when I was doing my academic work, I studied the example of the California drought. This was tons of attribution studies came out on the drought, and a lot of them said very different things. So the other said the causes of the drought are natural, not man-made. And this was very common. This was happening a lot in the mid-2010s, this type of thing. I read a couple papers about this, but basically there were a ton of different attribution studies, and when you're looking at something like drought, the variable that you're looking at really matters. So some of these studies looked at just the absence of precipitation, and some of the studies looked at the combination of precipitation and heat, and some of them looked at something called the Palmer Drought Severity Index. So it's really important when looking at things where the attribution has gotten kind of fuzzy and there's a lot of different types of studies coming out is to look at what are the variables, what is the time scale at which they're looking. This was a really long drought. So some people were looking at 2-year periods, some people were looking at 3-year periods. And that kind of explains why there were so many different types of results that were coming out on this issue. The other thing to think about is when we're talking about meteorological attribution versus damage attribution. So more and more scientists and modelers are trying to look at how much damage can be attributed to climate change in a particular event. So this is a study I reported on that said that climate change was to blame for $8 billion of the Hurricane Sandy damages. And now I think the thing that we just have to think about as reporters is that when you're going to damages, you're just getting into an area where the modeling is a lot more complex and a lot less precise in a lot of ways. Because, you know, damages, there's so many, James is going to talk a lot about this, but there's so many human factors that go into that that make it a lot harder to model than when you're just talking about fluid mechanics and things like that are actually easier. So in this example, researchers basically modeled two different worlds. They modeled the world with anthropogenic sea level rise and without, and then compared, they used this FEMA model to basically compare how much flooding damage there would have been in Manhattan and the surrounding areas. But the FEMA model is a little bit able to use this to model the actual resulting damages. Their damages were off, but they used it kind of as a scaling factor for sea level rise, anthropogenic versus not. So I think this is a fascinating study. I think they did an amazing job with this study, and it was very well worth covering. But in my coverage of it, I tried to sort of explain to the reader what are the uncertainties that are inherent here, and how did researchers try to account for those. And the final thing, and I think James is going to talk a lot more about this, but is what about vulnerability, and what are our roles as reporters in terms of making sure that we're talking about vulnerability? So Fred Pearce, who's a British journalist, did this amazing piece in Yale E360 where he said, you know, are we ignoring the other causes of disasters when we get too focused on event attribution and climate change? There's a couple, he gives the example of Lake Chad in Africa, and the Nigerian president has been very public about saying that, you know, the shrinking size of Lake Chad is due to climate change, but there's been a lot of hydrological modeling that says, you know, actually it's diversions for agriculture. Another example that we might think about, you know, Newsom came out post the Western wildfires and said very clearly, this is climate change. And he said, you know, forest management is part of the story, but it's not the story. And, you know, I mean, we could agree or disagree with him on that. And I think that there's growing awareness in academics, and I think among some journalists as well, that, you know, if we focus too much on climate change and if we don't, it's to become more vulnerable. An article that I really liked, and they basically just say, climate-centric disaster framing can erase from view and thus from policy agendas the very socioeconomic and political factors that most centrally cause vulnerability and suffering. And that's not to say, I mean, we definitely hook for actions that they may not have taken or management that they may not have done. Anyway, that's it for me. That's my little overview, and I think now we're going to James.
Cool. Switch over here.
I'll switch back. Sorry, musical chairs.
I made you a name slide to
perfect.
Mark the middle parts there.
Fantastic.
That's a place from your research, North Carolina.
Haven't done much yet there, but I'm working.
You do a wastewater?
So, yes, but...
I read your paper. Yes. How dare you?
The abstract of the conference session. Wonderful. Well, let's take a quick step back. Hello, everyone. I'm James Doss Gollin. So, I'm the nation's ground is really in water resource systems. These days, I'm spending a lot of time using combinations of data science tools and earth science tools and engineering tools. Lately been doing a lot of work on flooding, a little bit of stuff on energy systems too, but still also very interested in water systems. And so to sort of build on that last point, my sort of short message today is that climate change in and of itself doesn't cause disasters. Now that's a message bad faith actors love to exploit this and skip the next piece of this, which is that what climate change does do is expose the vulnerabilities that humans have created. And in particular, when we think about the ways that climate change impacts, right, the IPCC recently released a report on climate change impacts and found that, you know, we're doing a pretty good job modeling global temperatures, modeling many of the sort of large-scale heat and water and these other sort of fundamental cycles. But then when we're thinking about how they affect people, we're finding that even small amounts of climate change are affecting people more than we had anticipated. So this means a couple of things. Obviously, the first is that climate change is bad and we should do whatever we can to mitigate it. I think y'all have gotten that message so far. So I'm going to focus on the second, which is that an opportunity, I think, to sort of balance this, how do we talk about climate change but also talk about the sort of physical event actually cause human consequences. And I think that, again, hopefully, this is my first day at this conference, but I think a message that you've probably been hearing a lot is that we need to apply equity lenses to lots of these different issues. And so actually getting into the specifics of how the meteorology or the hydrology or whatever else is affecting humans will also be a way to help apply that equity lens. So here's an example. You know, for some of you probably were in Texas last February during this winter storm. Don't tell the meteorologists that we're calling it Winter Storm Uri, because they'll tell you that winter storms should not be named. but what we saw, this was in my own research, we showed that this was a storm that was pretty severe, but was not unprecedented or unimaginable within the context of the historical record. But what happened in a nutshell was that as it started to get cold in Texas, and we had great forecasts, so we knew for a while that it was going to be cold, but the natural gas supply chain in particular started to experience issues. So the natural gas supply chain is very complex. There's wells that froze, there's pipes, there's things that ran out of electricity, and so they couldn't push gas along through the system. So you also had, there were wind turbines that started to ice over. Again, wind turbines, natural gas, these are things that can operate in cold conditions. There's wind turbines in Scandinavia, and there's natural gas in Montana. So these aren't things that can't work in the cold, but they weren't designed here to work in the cold. And so we started to lose electricity supply. And at the same time, it was getting cold, and people were turning to electricity to heat their homes. In Texas, very roughly about half of homes are heated with electricity. And so people were starting to use more and more electricity at the same time that the electricity supplies were starting to fall. And so that led to massive cuts, basically, in order to keep the grid from falling apart. The operators had to just switch off power for large numbers of electricity a day, but they weren't able to do that. And so lots of people lost power for days at a time. Additionally, because it was now cold in lots of people's houses, and people didn't necessarily know, not being used to dealing with the cold, some counts there was more flood damage during this winter storm last February than there was during Hurricane Harvey across the state of Texas. I've seen $130 billion worth of flood damages is sort of a magnitude there. And I just anecdotally know from walking around my neighborhood that there were lots of, especially older houses, but also brand new construction where there were exposed pipes. So, you know, everyone thinks most of the time it's warm, not an issue, and then you get a really cold event like this and everything falls apart. Same thing, lots of banana trees, they're going to die. So sort of fundamentally what we saw with this winter storm was that we had impacts, cascading impacts through the infrastructure system. That it started with the electricity supply, cascaded into electricity and home heating. From there you had water impacts. As so many pipes were burst, the water systems lost pressure, roads were iced, so people's temperatures were things that we certainly knew were possible. A couple of other examples from other places. So droughts, we've probably seen some about, we talked a little bit about California, or Lake Chad is a good example. There have been severe droughts in Sao Paulo recently, in Cape Town, South Africa. So major cities were out of water. And I think one thing that's important to think about when we think about drought is that when we think about sort of defining drought from a physical perspective, there's hydrological droughts, there's agricultural droughts, there's meteorological droughts, all measuring slightly different slices of this complicated pie. But from a water resources perspective, drought just means that there's not as much water as people want or expect to have. And we know, we're very, very certain that under climate change, these water systems are going to get more variable. Sometimes there's going to be more extreme rainfall, lasting droughts. But at the same time, we also do have control over the human side. And so we can make decisions about how do we want to use our water in places where we know that there's potential for droughts. Just very briefly talking, since we're in Houston, we have to talk a little bit about Hurricane Harvey. The amount of, I think sometimes folks forget that the amount of rainfall that fell during Hurricane Harvey was biblical. It was of biblical proportions, right? You talk about sort of an average of 30 inches of rainfall over a huge area, much more in some places. Any city in the world is going to struggle with flooding as a result of that. But at the same time, we've built housing that's extremely vulnerable to flooding here. So there were, you know, houses that were actually on the back end of a reservoir that they didn't know when they bought the house that they were inside of a flood control reservoir. There's sort of building up, you know, lots and lots of construction in the floodplain. To look beyond Houston, we see there have been really good studies in North Carolina, lots of other places. Where are we doing development now? Where is new construction? Where are people building houses? It's often in the most low-lying, most vulnerable, most exposed locations. And so if we think about how do we want to manage flood risk in places like Houston, that means we need to think about where are people living, how do they get where they're living, how do we make sure that they have the infrastructure they need that can continue to operate during these kinds of floods. When we look at other places where there have been major tropical cyclones or hurricane impacts, right, been much improved. And, of course, this underlying social vulnerabilities and inequities that made it so that some people really weren't able to evacuate safely. You can skip this and cut right to the chase. So a couple of sort of suggestions for journalists coming from someone who's an engineer thinking about these systems. The first, this is not something I've talked about at all, but if you're going to talk at all about climate change with the general public, you're always going to get questions about, is renewable energy too expensive? Can we really do it? And if your understanding of that is 5 years out of date, it's a lifetime out of date. This is a space that's changing really, really, really rapidly. I'll shamelessly promote my colleague at Rice. Dan Cohen has a book that just came out. I believe they're selling it downstairs. There are other great places to get information on the renewable transition. But just, I think, in my experience, when talking with people about climate change, they'll say, oh, solar panels are so expensive, we don't know how to do it. And that's something that's changed a lot very quickly. Pivoting a little bit back to what I was talking about before, explaining sort of for a particular event, and this is what we engineers and scientists are terrible at. We're not good at this storytelling. So we need the help of journalists like you to explain, not like we can say what happened, but sort of how did that then go and create impacts for people. Because that will both explain sort of the attribution side or what caused it, but also how do we adapt and how do we hold accountable the people who should have helped us to be better prepared. And the last point I'll make is that decision-making around this is really difficult. And it's really easy to, you know, we talk with someone and they'll say, here's what we need to do to fix this. And then it becomes a how do we get the resources to do it? How do we convince people to take on my preferred solution? You can think about that with, you know, decisions about should we in cities, including sort of the Houston region, but New York, many other places, do we manage sea level rise through seawalls or through something else? And so if the question is, how do we adapt to this? That's sort of one set of questions, almost co-opted by particular favored solutions. And this sort of idea that we know the climate is changing, that we need to keep doing things exactly the way we're doing them, but just bigger and better to deal with the sort of climate of the future might not be a way to make decisions under uncertainty that makes a lot of sense. So I'll leave it there, and Mo's all you.
All right.
I found you a pipe with a nice sweater.
I appreciate that. This is what we call winterization, which we've heard a lot about last year. Yeah, I'm not sure. I didn't come with a lot of slides. I just basically sent Joe some different pictures of events I've reported on over the last, oh my goodness, 15 years of reporting in Texas on extreme weather events. And I might cycle through some of those.
You won't. That's the only one I was able to get.
That's the one you got?
Yeah.
All right. Well, we're not going to do it. My favorite was the that might have been a little bit weird for you, honestly. I was sitting there thinking maybe we shouldn't show the guy. A lot of the points that have been raised so far have been right up my alley, journalist. And so I think if I'm going to serve any purpose in this panel, it will just be to bounce off some of these and think about how how I've encountered them in the practice of reporting. You know, pretty much you do everything you could think of when it comes to extreme weather in the state. And most recently, for the last year plus, I feel like my life has revolved around reporting on the winter storm, on the black. You know, I say winter storm, what I should say is the blackout that happened because of the winter storm. Did a podcast on that called The Disconnect, Power Politics and the Texas Blackout. We're working on a second season for that actually right now. So if you are visiting from out of town or if you're from here, I'd reckon in the few days you've been here, you've probably heard people already refer to this event. We also heard about it here in this panel. Clearly something that just continues to reverberate through Texas, and a perfect example, I think, of what we're talking about today. My initial thoughts when Joe asked me about this panel were the different ways in which we approach extreme weather. As you mentioned in your intro, it really is a breaking news event, especially when we're dealing with storms, right? I mean, hurricane making landfall. Your job may be quite simply to alert people where to find safety or what to do to try to stay safe. And at that moment, the climate implications of this event may not be the thing that you want to talk about or people necessarily need to hear about. So if I'm going to offer any advice in terms of looking at these things in the immediate sense through a climate lens, it would be preparation. Especially and unfortunately, because we encounter these things so often, we know we're going to encounter them again. And if you take the time to educate yourself about how climate interacts with each of these individual phenomena, you can use that in your immediate reporting, even perhaps in the breaking situation, to kind of let people know how human activity may relate to what they're experiencing or why they're seeing it more frequently. I've thought about, like I said, I've reported on almost every kind of extreme weather you could imagine here in Texas, and I think there's different kinds of extreme weather. We have these storms, these massive storms, these hurricanes. We just had tornadoes come through just north of Austin, a couple weeks ago. We had a wildfire just a month ago or so. But then you also have the more kind of slow-rolling, life-engulfing, lifestyle-changing things. And, we have something like drought that can last years and years and years. And you have something near and dear to my heart, which is extreme heat, which destroys your lifestyle in a way that, is really immediate for people. So I'm trying to think about, as someone who tries to include a climate question in my reporting, I think it's the issue of heat is the one that I've gotten the most response from my listeners. For some reason, that particular thing resonates with them. And when I report on that, through looking at, climate, how climate change is increasing the number of, people love the idea of triple-digit days. Once you hit those triple digits, people want to talk about it, they want to talk about it at work, they're thinking about it. And if you can bring people to that and talk about how climate change, along with other factors, contribute to such things, you have people. Some of my most, if you look at web traffic stories, are on extreme heat in Austin, which is not fun. They don't advertise that when they talk about all the live music. That's an interesting, I'm just kind of thinking about this topic, and it's not necessarily the hurricane or even the winter storms, it's often the things that are encroaching in our day-to-day lives that where people are talking to each other and they're saying, it wasn't like this 20 years ago, man. Like in my lifetime, in Austin, Texas, 30 years ago, they maybe had 12 triple-digit days a year. And we're between 30 and 50 now. You know what I mean? Like, and that's on average. We've had years where it's been 90, you know? So these things that aren't maybe necessarily the huge catastrophic events, but that are the creeping, creeping patterns that are kind of insinuating themselves into our lived experience are, I think, great opportunities to approach climate for people. Mm-hmm. I talked about being prepared, you know, as a reporter to then like be understanding of the science and to be able to kind of bring it into your reporting in an accessible way, and that's a good example of where you could do that. I mean, I have a whole bunch of different meteorologists and climate scientists who I've spent a lot of time talking to, so that every summer I know that this stuff's going to come up because it's all people want to talk about. People love talking about the weather. I really appreciated the conversation about the blackout, and I just wanted to talk a little bit about language in that context, because this is something that I've struggled with ever since this event happened, and it's something that I noticed changing in the immediate aftermath of that. You already kind of got an overview about what happened, but you know, we had this massive winter storm, and it shut down our infrastructure essentially, and this was a failure of our physical infrastructure, and it was also a failure of our like market infrastructure and the financial systems that we had arranged in the state of Texas, which are very unique to the state, to buy and sell and distribute electricity. So it was this really complicated thing that just crapped out, like in the face of this big cold front that came in. And to appropriately hold those accountable who designed the system, and to intentionally try to like report on possible solutions to make sure it never happens. In the weeks, even in the weeks after that happened, and it was, just cosmically, I think, traumatic for so many people that lived through it. I started noticing policymakers use the URI word, right? We were no longer talking about the blackout. Mm-hmm. We were talking about, first we're talking about a winter storm, and then we're talking about a winter storm that had a name, URI. And suddenly the problem was this storm. You know, the problem was never the storm. If it got super cold, and when that cold front first came through, it was kind of exciting, because you got to go sledding in Austin, which was for me a rare treat. But when the power went out, again, that was frightening. But nobody expected it to be out for days, as it was, and then when the water started failing because the power had been out and because of all the issues associated with that, that was something else nobody expected. These were the things that caused the crisis. The power failing, the water failing, everything else failing. And it is interesting to me that those in power typically prefer to talk about the storm and to talk about URI rather than the blackout or all the other failures.
URI did this to us.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. And so, and it's an easy shorthand for reporters, and it's tempting, I think, to fall into that. But it is, I think, really useful to always be conscious of the language you use. When I know I said winter storm right when I sat down here, but cool event, but mostly try to focus on the blackout, because really that's what we're talking about. Mm. And again, this is a kind of double-edged thing. I'm reminded also of like even like Hurricane Katrina. You know what I mean? Like that was obviously a devastating hurricane, but the levee problem was, right. You know, was to, I know we're here to talk about climate change, and I'm certainly not trying to take the focus off of that, but I think that I'm simply, like I said, kind of echoing what we've already heard, when we don't want to make that appear to be a kind of inevitable act of God type thing in our journalism. And I mean, I think that those are most of the little notes that I made here. But I'd love to open it up and hear from people and talk about it.
Yeah, we've noticed the same thing. In Colorado, especially with wildfires lately, as much as a lot of parts of Colorado are very progressive on a lot of the climate issues, still there's a lot of obfuscating on some of the local adaptation stuff and preparation for this stuff. And Act of God, I mean, Mose and I have talked a little bit about this. Yeah. And covering, I started in Oklahoma, he in Texas, and the climate conversation has changed a lot even in Oklahoma and Texas over the last 10 years. But there is a real, like, kind of pointing to the sky or pointing at Uri, right, and saying, you know, this sort of like, oh my gosh, these huge forces beyond our control are doing this to us, when a lot of the story is about the system that we built and the people that we've entrusted to handle these systems, not taking the risk seriously. So, real quick question, just for you, Shannon. On the attribution science stuff, we had that chart where you kind of showed the graph of the different types of events and how much the science is dependable on that stuff. Can you talk a little bit about a particular event on a particular day versus the overall trend of saying we know these things are getting more common, or certainty is X amount more likely on any given time due to human involved climate change.
Yeah, totally. Any one event. A lot of what the media, sort of people who were clued in the media were saying is they were making these more like long term statements. So they would say something like, we know that due to climate change, we expect droughts to become longer and more intense, or we know that we expect to see more heat waves. And I think going back to what Mose is saying about breaking news, because, you can look at the National Academies of Science report. There's tons of academic work out there where scientists have basically, it's a lot easier because they can just model into the future. They take our, expected trajectories of greenhouse gas emissions and warming, and they can say, yeah, look, we see that there's going to be way worse droughts in the western U.S.
Right.
And so that's very easy. You can turn to those publications and those papers and just make those kind of long-term statements. And that's sort of an easy go-to. And then when it comes to the actual attributing of an event, scientists are trying to do it much faster.
They're getting pretty fast
at
some of them,
yeah. I mean, the World Weather Attribution Service, they do rapid attribution, so they can turn it around sometimes in like a week or a few days, which is really different from waiting for peer review for basically 2.5 years or something along those lines. So they're getting a lot faster, but that is still, like, it will take a few days for them to get it together and say, this is what we think the increase in risk is due to climate change. So in terms of a breaking news situation, you're always, and for certain situations, it's easier than others. Like, you can't really make a statement like this around tornadoes. Mm-hmm. You just kind of can't. But for droughts and wildfires, you can say things like, we think that the condition, like scientists say that the conditions for large wildfires are going to become much worse as we go forward. That's not to say that climate change caused the lightning to strike on this hillside, but it is to say that the conditions allowed that.
Yeah, about being careful about your language and how you describe this stuff, I think is really good. Wildfires we report on a lot in Colorado, and we're careful to do that, to talk about climate change helping fuel the conditions for these types of fires, more frequent versions of these fires or more intense versions of these fires, but also like talking about that human layer over it too, right? Not only are we living in a time in Colorado where these fires are getting more intense, they're acting weirder, and they're happening in places where they haven't always happened, but people are living closer to these areas where there's fires. Half of the people in Colorado live in a place where there could be a fire. And then also talking about the other factors. 90% of the fires in Colorado are caused by people, right? They're not caused by lightning. They're not caused by natural causes. They're caused by somebody doing something. So even if the climate change has created conditions to make these fires very, very dangerous, the fuels and the drought, and that there are other factors in that we haven't adapted in our response to that growing risk. So, yeah. Any other thoughts on that?
I agree.
Agree.
Yeah, I think that it's...
Definitely want to give time for people to ask questions, and I think how we have to do it is we are recording this, I think, to save it for members. So if you want to come up, somehow if you come up and talk here, the sound will be recorded. And just tell us your name and affiliation if you'll kind of come up to the middle here and tell us your name and affiliation. And we're supposed to let SEJ members get first crack at questions, but I know the little stickers on your badges are – I don't have a sticker. I am a, I'm a long-time member, but so it's – I know. It's I know, but it's honor system. I trust if you're up first in line, you are a member.
We'll have time for everybody.
Tell us who you are.
Kathy Kowalski, freelance. I am a member.
Yeah, perfect. You're where you're supposed to be.
My question is, when you're looking at, you know, conditions, climate, say, okay, you know, like maybe Ohio is getting wetter, changes affecting you now, look for perhaps more of these extreme weather conditions that the utilities don't consider like a normal thing, right? Like, and more outages. So I'm looking for kind of advice as to how to the science.
I mean, a lot of this also goes back to, you mentioned utilities, and so, you know, you could look at that question of, like, public infrastructure. And all the shape of our infrastructure in this country right now would not be good even if there was no such thing as global warming or climate change, right?
It's falling apart anyway, right?
Yeah, like, we're not in good shape. The public investments in these things, which were robust, maybe like, you know, mid last century into, you know, for several decades, has kind of fallen off. A lot of the management of a lot of these things have also been given up more and more to private entities with you know, less public oversight, and so this is a an economic and kind of governmental historical trend that we're already living in the legacy of. When you put the uncertainties surrounding climate-related weather extremes on top of that, you're dealing with a really, like, frightening kind of situation. And so maybe I'm being overly vague, and I'd love to hear some of the more, like, you know, specifically scientific answers to this question, but I think that it is absolutely reasonable to just make people aware of the added layer of risk that is the story, I think, of a lot of these disasters that we've seen. And a lot of
favorite boogeyman, which is the 100-year storm. it's a way of thinking about things that I think is very frustrating and limiting, but it's also the way that lots of our infrastructure was designed.
What is a 100-year storm?
Yeah. So walk through about how big does that culvert needs to be is based on, we look at, you know, time series of rainfall. Depending on the situation, maybe you'll look at, like, what's the most rainfall you get in a year over a 12-hour span or a 1-hour span or a 24-hour span, one of those things. And then you fit a statistical distribution to it, to this time series where you have, like, one sort of your largest event in that percent of years. So you're going to extrapolate that distribution out to the, you know, 99th percentile. And then you're going to say that's our design event, and we're going to make the culvert be large enough for that. So I think one thing that's interesting is to go back and a massive storm, but if there's small-scale flooding, find out what was the infrastructure there, what was it designed for? And then the NOAA, the National Oceanographic and Atmospheric Administration, see if I can get my acronyms.
Nailed it.
Not butcher them too bad.
Close, anyway.
They have something called Atlas 14.
Administration.
Atlas 14 is their sort of estimates of what are, under today's climate, they're not forward-looking, they're not thinking about climate change, they're trying to estimate today's climate only, but what would those, you know, if you redesign that infrastructure, what are the rainfall amounts that you would put in today? And so I think that can be a very simple way, and it's sort of a very, like, there's no models, it's all sort of observationally based, to say, look, not even looking to the future, but just looking today, if you were going to redesign that stormwater infrastructure, it would be, you know, 30% larger diameter or something else. And that might be a way to sort of explain some of these issues in a sort of just here's the change that we've already seen.
I could give a real world example of that, because I'm hearing someone talk Atlas 14 is just makes me so excited. I'm usually in a place where you can just. But in Austin, we you know, we had a lot of flood mitigation infrastructure put in, and yeah, maybe about 20 years ago or 30 years ago, that were based on these projects, rainfall estimates that are reflected in, you know, in these Atlas projects. And when they came out with a new one, with a new estimate, we're talking about, you know, millions and millions of dollars. It shows immediately that all of those investments that were meant to take whole neighborhoods out of the flood zone are suddenly not doing that anymore. They're not up to snuff. And all these people that lived in what they thought were protected parts of town are suddenly in a high flood risk area again, and with all the inherent risks and needs for insurance and whatnot that are associated with that. And that is, like you said, it's a data story. I mean, like, there's no arguing with that. There's no even real necessarily like politics behind it. It's like, we had these numbers, now they're different, and now there's this huge like human and social cost to it. Specific, and that's perfect. Yeah.
Name and where you're from. Sorry. People.
I can tell you exactly.
No idea who you are.
And I attended a local meeting. It's not my basement, it isn't happening, but the guy from the combined, or from the Metropolitan Sewer District, people were like, why is this happening now? And he said, well, I don't want to get political, but rainstorm has increased 40% since, I think, the 50s. And I just thought, okay, that's climate change, but he doesn't want to say it out loud.
Right.
And this is a pretty progressive suburb, so he probably could have said it, but I just think, yeah, our infrastructure, it would cost billions. It was built around the time of the Civil War. And
mm-hmm.
there's these combined sewers, so all the rainwater just, you know, I'm sure all the Midwest.
Yeah.
The Northeast is like that. So I just want to throw that out there.
Yeah, it is interesting. And as somebody, you know, reporting on this stuff, in some ways it's good because let's not get political. Just give me the engineer. In a lot of cases, you can cut. You know, what's it designed for? You know, let's just you know, if you can get to them, you can cut through some of that political stuff and just talk to the person that runs that works for the highway department and is designing roads and stuff. You know, are these roads designed to flood? Are these roads designed to extend the heat and stuff like that? You can. Maybe cut through some of the political layers and just talk to the engineers, just talk to the designers of some of the stuff. And I mean, some of it's scary. Not only you'll have a weird new lens to look through stuff of everything out there that ain't ready.
Yeah.
Any other? Yeah.
Yeah. David Helvarga, SEJ member, author. Part of the response, I think, is marketing. I mean, after what you were saying, Joe, I think, like, come to Austin for, you know, great music and hot times.
Oh, right.
Or, you know, Venice, come to Houston next summer.
Yeah.
But I'm wondering, on our panel yesterday, we were talking after Katrina, you know, huge investment with the Army Corps in shoring up the levees around New Orleans, and then an ongoing investment in land restoration in southern Louisiana. I'm wondering, after Uri and the blackouts, you know, other than the governor targeting trans youth to appease an angry god, has there really been a focus on hardening the energy infrastructure in the state?
Yeah, that's a great question. Let's settle in. We're going to be here for a few hours. There's been
It's fixed, right?
Yeah.
They learned their lesson.
It's interesting.
Government really did.
Do you see the expectations game that was played this past winter was fascinating, because you had politicians who kind of had an interest in almost like kind of ginning up concern and fear, so to then be able to say, hey, look, you know, nothing happened, it didn't happen again, and so that must mean that the problem's solved, and the problem isn't solved. You know, when you talk to the majority of independent, you know, observers, you know, there's still tons of things that have not been corrected that led to the blackout. The natural gas supply chain has not been winterized. It's winterized. This is a power plant. They did mandate winterization of power plants, which means, you know, so they can operate in cold weather. And now we're finally following that standard. Is that sufficient? I mean, it's a 10-year-old standard. So it is something that they did, though. They're currently also overhauling the energy market in the state. You know, I a lot of people tell me, and from what I've seen, there's just not much of a cost-benefit analysis to what they're actually doing. They say, seeing like argument set out exactly for how that is, but there is certainly, it seems, more energy capacity on the grid maintained is another great question. You know, I mean, like, these things do need to get, plants need to get shut down for maintenance. There are all sorts of things arise. But I'd love to hear your thoughts.
Yeah, and, you know, your point about maintenance is actually, that I think is also a good one to bring in a climate change lens. Because here in, like, a small part of the reason why so many thermal power plants were offline in Texas grid is completely designed for air conditioning, so summer peaks. As you get, you know, and we're already seeing it, we know it's going to continue, you get hotter summers that last longer. So whereas, you know, your air conditioning peaks where you really need all your electricity plants on, you know, maybe it would have ended in early September and now it's going into late September. If you now need to be ready for winter storm electric generation, that window that you have to do maintenance is getting narrower. So that's just another variable that's making everything a little bit trickier.
Yeah.
But to the question about sort of is the grid ready for cold now, it's really hard to know. It's right, extremes and vulnerabilities to extreme events, you don't really know until you know. But there are sort of, in the same way that there are models that we can use to sort of study physical systems and sort of large-scale climate, there are also vulnerability models that you can run. They're not as precise. You have to make a lot more strong assumptions. They're less perfect. But you can, you know, if you have enough data, you can try to assess them. You can also use data. So one thing we saw is that don't remember if it was February or January, but this past winter, we got some very mild cold. And you can look at sort of the real-time data of, like, flows of natural gas out of the pipes out in West Texas where a lot of it's coming from. And that already was starting to drop off. So I think, you know, you can try to piece together some of those different. On the other hand, maybe there was a reliable baseline that was winterizing the West Fresno. It's hard to sort of get objective and definitive answers to those.
One of the things in the Northwest, we know will happen with climate change is multiple cascading different climate disasters, which is a little bit different from what you guys were talking about. One thing that cascades as systems fail, but like the cycle of wildfire followed by flooding and mudslides followed by drought. You know, I mean, just the things that cause the next thing. And I'm just wondering if you've got examples about that.
Boy, we do. I know I do. In Colorado, she's talking. One thing she's talking about is like burn scar flooding. When a fire comes through, it'll clear out the roots and the trees and the stuff that hold the soil together. It also melts the vegetation. It makes this waxy. You'll have a fire come through, and then a rain event, and it'll flood like crazy. We had the main corridor through Colorado, which is I-70, if you've ever been up to the ski areas and been in traffic, just shut down the whole, this was not during a ski time of the year, although that did freak people out, that possibility of happening.
Right.
But, you know, we had to, you know, trucks just being rerouted. We had, like, the trucking, you know, logistics people just be like, we're going to have to just shift all, like, traffic outside of Colorado. We're going to have to shift it up to I-80 through Wyoming because we can't get trucks through there. There's no other way to get through the mountains in this area. So, yeah, definitely. I mean, that's a place not built for that type of flooding. You can't really design a road to withstand a mudslide in any way, you know, through a tiny little mountain pass. So, yeah, we're seeing that stuff. And you know, in this case, there's just not a great solution. We've carved one path through this mountain. It's now vulnerable to mudslides from this burn scar. And the remedy for this, you can't plant trees fast enough to protect that erosion. And then the erosion itself prevents the trees and the soil from even taking hold there. So now you're in this weird complex engineering stuff where they're, you know, do we build a whole new road for hundreds and hundreds of millions of dollars? Do we just count on this thing not being reliable for the next 5 to 7 years? It's that's a big one, certainly, where I'm from, which is just these, multiple system failures, all based upon just a road that's been there for 100 years.
And I would just add to that, there are some climate scientists and modelers who are also trying to look at this sort of this cascading effect. Daniel Swain in California has done a lot of different modeling on sort of the drought, catastrophic rainfall, flooding, wildfire nexus that sort of repeats and cycles and makes California a sort of miserable place to live right now. And so I think that there's increasing attempts on the part of scientists to try to track, you know, okay, what is...
Interesting stories about, like, a fire in, you know, 1 year leads to, like, a trucking failure 5 years, you know, later, which is just, it's weird butterfly effect type of stuff, you know, how a person dragging their chains, you know, up a mountain road becomes no trucks, you know, allowed in that road, you know, 5 years later because it's just this... series of failures.
The only thing I'll say there is, like, there it's very much an active area of research. So I think there's, you know, folks are, like, keywords to search for, like, about, like, models, and you had that great chart where you have sort of how much are things going to change and how sort of what are the uncertainties associated with it. And when you need, like, to resolve things at the global scale to get these heat waves, but then you also need to resolve these really, really local scale things to understand these impacts, and that's something that's still difficult. There's specific cases where people have done a really good job, but you may, when you go and you ask a scientist, they may say, we're not able to predict that very well in the future.
Yeah, and a lot of this infrastructure stuff, I mean, it wasn't ever originally planned, not only for any of the stuff happening now, but some of why they're there is just accident. I mean, this road in Colorado was a wagon road, you know, centuries ago that just became a dirt road and then a gravel road, and eventually it's an interstate. You know, nobody put any thought into, is this the best place to put this thing? I mean, they just put it where it had always been. It's a goat path, you know, and then it becomes a wagon path, then it becomes a trail and then a road. So this stuff was not always thoughtfully arranged to begin with, and now, you know, it's there and contending with.
One thing I would that I've run up into in my reporting that I think is important for journalists to remember is that, like, a lot of what is commonly thought to be the natural world, as insofar as such a thing really exists, is not actually natural. And so you could, like, you know, there's a lake in downtown Austin called Lady Bird Lake. I think most people that live there just think it's a lake, right? They don't realize that it's actually is a dammed up part of the Texas Colorado River that was created as a cooling pond for a gas power plant in East Austin, right? This whole thing that's this kind of considered this gorgeous natural amenity was really created for this industrial, you know, use decades ago. Power plant's gone. It's good for me because I would have lived right near it, actually, but if it was still operational. But the lake is there, and the lake is considered a natural feature of the city, but it's not, and it requires maintenance, and it requires this dam to be operating. And when we have natural disasters, it exposes all of those underlying things that are actually maintaining what we always thought was just a normal part of the natural landscape.
Yeah, back there. Yeah.
I do have a question, but I'm not a member, so I yield to somebody else.
Please, that'd be great. Sorry, we'll get to you, I promise.
Hi, Michael Codas with Inside Climate News. Biked for many years near my home by the Gilbert White Memorial. It's a memorial to the guy who created the concept of the 100-year flood. Huh. I'm kind of curious about discussions about kind of total reworkings of systems that actually are poorly designed from the beginning. I mean, we're talking about improving infrastructure to be able to maintain things, but when we think in terms of the Texas grid, you're talking about a unique grid that doesn't play very well with others,
right.
And when we look back historically at that, it's like, this actually was never going to work very well. Have you had any luck in kind of, doing stories that kind of change the conversation about this? California, I write a lot about wildfire. California is a great example where we have, you know, huge blackouts because of power lines that start wildfires and the lawsuits over that. And, there are a lot of new discussions about, well, you know, we ought to have these lines underground or wrapped somewhere else.
Yes.
But boy, that's billions of dollars now. We've committed to this system that's never going to work at the level that we wanted and is getting increasingly stressed by development and climate.
I mean, I think I understand your question, and it's kind of like the answer. I don't know. I don't want to be too depressing, but like it's not. I'm not convinced that by offering solutions, it's always going to find its way into policy, right? I do know that, like, in the reporting we've done and the podcast we put together, I've heard people talk about the grid and the issues surrounding it in a way that tells me, oh, they've listened to our reporting. You know, like, in some of the issues that have been raised, and not just ours, but a lot of the great reporting around this, but even the way it's framed, I feel like we have had some influence in the public conversation. But it really depends on how far out you're willing to think about what type of overhaul is politically, you know, realistic. I mean, ultimately you run up against politics, and I don't know which are backed up by the facts, but that doesn't always translate into great policy outcomes. I mean, that's just the really hard part about this job. I don't know what else to say about that.
Are you seeing the conversations that you say you have?
For sure. Yeah. Absolutely.
I think you had your hand up last time.
Ed Yon from Portland, Oregon. Like 116-degree summers now.
Okay, great. Welcome. Yeah. This is turning into like a triple-digit therapy.
Yeah.
Climate reporting is typically coming from science and environment reporters who have expertise in science and environment. And what I'm hearing you talk about is really that expertise is needed on a planning level, on a engineering level, and a political level. And basically my question for you is make me feel better. Because I do fear like that we're coming at this maybe from the wrong angle and over-sciencing people. You know,
yeah.
The science, more information on the science, but actually needing some expertise there.
Sure. Yeah, I don't know that I'll be much of a salve, except that so a lot of this that we're talking about is in some measure of our control, if with enough political will and people responding enough, and it is hitting home more, I think for people, whether it's really hot days in Austin, in Colorado, it's people breathing in smoke and having a hard time breathing. We've been doing this a long time and haven't seen as much people. We talk about ozone and air quality and smoke, and nothing changes the conversation more than if you're a parent and you're thinking, like, do I want my kids out at recess today? Or you're like, you go for a bike ride and you're like, I'm not sure I can do it today, you know? So I think some of this is hitting home enough that people are starting to demand answers and ask questions. And on the other extreme end of that, if you lose your home in a fire or a flood, if you're looking at your insurance bill and you start asking questions and demanding answers from people that you feel should know and be prepared. So I think out of the realm of climate change, maybe to a lot of people being an ethereal thing that they don't have a lot of control about, that they are demanding more answers of people that do have more say over some of the decision making.
I just have sort of a sad story about this, which is when I was doing research on the California drought, and I was interested in to what extent these stories that were coming out about the connection of the drought to climate change were changing people's minds. So I went to California and I was doing a bunch of focus groups with different types of folks and showing them these stories, and the sort of sad thing was that the stories weren't, you know, and this is a small study, so we can't extrapolate to the whole world, but the stories weren't really moving the needle that much in terms of people who believed in climate change already thought that the droughts were climate change. People who didn't believe in climate change, it was not going to change.
Not convinced,
and, yeah. They were not going to say, oh, well, now that there's this drought and you're telling me it's climate change, that didn't work. So that was sort of a sad experience for me as a researcher to say, okay, here's this thing that, you know, a lot of scientists initially when event attribution was coming out, they were like, oh, this is going to be the thing that's really going to get people moving and thinking about extreme weather and thinking about climate change more seriously. And I think to some extent it has done that for people who were already believed in climate in that sense. I guess the point of hope that I would see is that I do feel like climate journalism is really moving out of science desks, and that we're seeing a lot more political journalists being engaged on climate change, and it's less siloed, and I haven't been in the industry very long, but it seems like it's becoming increasingly less siloed in science and health and only talking to scientists and only looking at that perspective. But I think from doing that research, my reporting and sort of my approach is that I've just gone more and more solutions as time has gone on, because I'm just not really convinced about how much sort of sounding the alarm can really do at this point.
Mm-hmm. But if you could show that climate stress contributed to Kim Kardashian getting hit with Pete Davidson, I think a lot of people would be.
I think just to jump off of that point, I think a question to ask is, what is the goal? Is the goal for people to recognize that climate change is real? That's turns out, it seems like it's really hard in this politicized and polarized world. If the goal is to get people excited about the renewable energy transition and the promise of, like, all the cool things we can do with cheap, abundant electricity that doesn't cause air quality problems, and your neighbor in your nice suburban community won't be blowing their annoying gas mower and
leaf blower,
maybe this is something that I can get behind. If it's a recognition of, you know, climate is going to affect, basically, I mean, someone who thinks about adaptation, we need to have climate not be its own standalone thing, but climate is going to affect everything. It's going to affect our food systems, our water systems, our energy systems. And so, you know, I don't think any one person is going to have the expertise to you know, answer all of those questions.
We're almost running out of time, but we're going to try to power through these questions. And Jeff, I promise we're going to get to you. We'll do somebody in the corner, so maybe Zach, Corner, Jeff, and we'll move along.
Sure. Yeah, so I'm an editor at a news site in Berkeley, California, and we're starting a climate beat at a city level and really struggling to sort of figure out what it means to tell those stories. I love the idea of, like, looking at these flood estimates, these rainfall estimates, and sort of, like, trying to, like, figure out how the city infrastructure is sort of set up to hold that. I was wondering if anyone had any other ideas sort of in that vein about, like, ways to look at sort of whether city infrastructures are set up to handle what's coming.
What should we start asking for? Give us a quick rundown of what scary climate prep plans from city stuff should we have.
I think the small scale stuff is in some ways easier. So, you know, stormwater infrastructure, these are things, it's easier in the sense that, like, the designs are not, where you start talking about how are you going to design a dam that's, you know, creating a lake for the whole city. Lots and lots of considerations are going into that. Whereas the more small scale stuff, people are just applying standards, like looking up some numbers at a table and deciding, okay, this is what we need to do. So I think those are opportunities. I think things like electricity grids and sort of what's the, like, demand that the grid is designed to handle. And sort of how likely do people think it is to exceed that? I think that's another opportunity.
Are there any places to look at for sort of what electric grid, like
extreme weather, like social policies, like cooling centers? Mm-hmm. You know, like what policies are around even like water breaks or? But I know, like in Austin, more and more they need to focus on getting people into air conditioned spaces, especially people without homes, you know. So anything around that. Also, like, just the way that, you know, I mean, I know that this stuff kind of gets farther and farther away, but, like, questions of, like, of shade in the public space, you know, all those different kind of local questions are climate questions, too.
Back in the corner.
My name is Zoe. I'm a reporter from GRIS. I'm Shannon's colleague.
I have a question for the industry. This is a setup, I can tell.
As these extreme weather events, get worse and more frequent, there have been, it seems like everyone and their mother has a solution that they are saying could fix the problem. I'm having a little bit of trouble figuring out which solutions are the right ones. For me to figure out what's bullshit and what's not, is the Army Corps right? Is the Millionaire Funding a green project right?
Mm.
How do you sift through that?
Right.
I welcome any other answers to
I'm wearing the wrong shirt. I should have worn, I have a t-shirt that someone gave me that says, if we have data, let's use data. If we want, if we're going to go with opinions, let's go with mine.
Yeah.
And that, you know, I think is the right way to think about it. And I think there are a lot of people who are trying in the energy space, in the water space, thinking about green infrastructure, thinking about like what might infrastructure based only on look like. It's really hard to frequency. You'll have people say, oh, what we need to do is install more bioswitch. Sometimes just having a little bit of a quantitative handle on, like, what are the, you know, is this something that's feasible or not? But I think that sort of to answer your questions is really hard to get a sense. And different experts will come to different conclusions. And so I don't think necessarily that there's going to be an easy answer for, you know, if we work or whether it won't work. So I'm sorry.
Jeff, and then we'll close it out.
Thank you so much. So I'm Jeff. I work at Cornell University, and I do media relations with a focus on climate and energy and the environment. I wanted to ask a question specific to Texas and wildfires. During the most recent wildfires in Central Texas, we were trying to figure out, get some insight on what does this mean? Is this going to happen more often? And one of the things I learned from one of our climate modelers is that Central Texas is right on the dividing line between the part of the country that's getting less water and the part of the country that's getting more water, and that line is sort of debated in terms of where it is. And so because of that, it's really hard to model what the region is going to look like going forward. Is there going to be more wildfires and, you know, shrubs versus forests? So I'm just curious, how are you thinking about that in Texas? Are you thinking about more wildfires going forward? Is that modeling challenging?
Well, I think you did some reporting on that.
The dividing line. I did on that because it goes through Oklahoma too. Forget the parallel, but I don't know about the Texas component of that too, but it is shifting east.
Yeah. So there's growing concern around wildfires. Absolutely. The one that happened most recently was, if we're talking about the same one, was actually a prescribed burn that went wrong and burned. A lot of the Lost Pines Forest outside of Austin, which had already suffered a huge wildfire in 2011. Wildfires are increasingly happening and are a concern, and there's a climate component to that. I don't think that's a satisfactory answer though. But
no, that's good. I mean, I guess my question is along like, what are the modeling challenges? I guess that's kind of what I've been learning.
Yeah.
And it sounds really hard because of the geography.
I see what you're saying.
But
yeah.
I don't know if that's something that you had encountered.
As a reporter based in Central Texas, you are correct about. I talked to some. We are experiencing both. You know, we are experiencing greater rainfall events and you times when it feels almost more tropical. And then, drought for a year where it doesn't rain, and suddenly we feel like we're in West Texas. At the risk of kind of like extrapolating that experience to the science, when I talk to scientists and modelers, and I'd love to hear, you know, anyone's take on that. Like, there are still some questions about where things might fall out. But broadly speaking, what I understand is that it's the line is moving east, and it's getting drier. We are in Central Texas. Yeah.
I don't have a great answer to that. I know that modeling wildfires is difficult. I know there's folks who've given a lot of thought to it, and I haven't. So I don't have a very clear sense of that.
I get the impression that the might wind up being a pretty good model for California.
Mm. Yeah, a lot of it just has to do with things, you know, climate's a part of it, but development is a huge part of it, too.
You can reach out to the Joint Fire Science Program, which has done some studies and modeling on that. One thing that's been pretty well documented is what you're describing, which is the relativity between pulses of moisture and drought, which very often the moisture is seen as something that's good to reduce fire. But what it's very often resulting in is huge green ups with 5 or 6 or 7 times more grass growing.
Yeah, wet spring, hot summer. Yeah, that's a.
What we saw
yeah.
The Marshall Fire.
Exactly.
Right after Christmas in Colorado as well.
We are over time, but yeah, thanks for coming. I hope it was good.